We are in Book 3, the Book of the Divine Mother, Canto 3, the House of the Spirit, and the New Creation. And last week we finished reading the second section of the description of the New Creation. So we'll read on from there on page 329 at the break. You'll start, Anton.
Against this glory of spiritual states, their parallels and yet their opposites, floated and swayed, eclipsed and shadow-like, as if a doubt made substance flickering veil, this other scheme two vast negations found. A world that knows not its inhabiting self labors to find its cause and need to be. A spirit ignorant of the world it made, obscured by matter, travestied by life, struggles to emerge, to be free, to know and reign. These were close ties in one disharmony, yet the divergent line.
So Aswapati has been seeing this glory of spiritual states, the new creation which has grown from a seed which was encased in the light. There's no ignorance or imperfection. It is ruled by perfection. All the powers that we have here, mind and life and substance, matter, they are also there, but in their perfect forms. And the relationships between all the beings are also perfect. A very, very beautiful description of the new creation, which perhaps we can say corresponds to the supramental world, maybe. And we noticed that somehow these wonderful states and experiences are familiar to us somehow. There's something in us which feels that, yes, that's how things are meant to be. That's how they should be. And we suffer because it's not like that. So now Aswapati is seeing that against this glory of spiritual states, there's another world, this other scheme, which is based on two vast negations. And in this other scheme, he sees the parallels of those spiritual states, and yet their opposites. There's like reflections, but they look exactly opposite to what is there. Those opposites are kind of vague, floating, swaying, eclipsed, darkened, like shadows, as if actually it's a doubt which has been made substance. It's flickering and pale. This other scheme based on two vast negations. That's our world, our universe. This is a world that doesn't know, it's ignorant of the self which is inhabiting it. So it is struggling to find out why it exists. And on the other side, that's one of the negations. And the other negation is a spirit who is in a way lost, obscured by matter. It's ignorant of the world it made. It's obscured by matter, travestied by life. If you make a travesty of something, you make a kind of caricature that makes it as unlike itself as it really can be. It's parallel and yet it's opposite. So that spirit is struggling to emerge, to be free, to gain knowledge, to gain mastery, to reign. And this world and this spirit are tied closely together in disharmony, not in harmony. They're pulling in opposite directions. The divergent lines are moving off in opposite directions. They don't meet at all. This is not the real truth of our world, but it's what it looks like in contrast to that glory of spiritual states. And it's what it looks like to the ignorant consciousness. It sees that this world we know seems to have emerged from, be governed by an unknowing force, an unconscious material force that has given rise to all these forms. And when at the level of consciousness, at the human level, it seems to be governed by a soul in a body, a soul that's imprisoned and struggling in the body. And it seems to be going towards a state where there's a silent spirit which says no to life, that separates itself from this manifestation that's been made by an unconscious force. So at the human level, this seems to be an infelicitous interlude, an unfortunate, unhappy interlude, a short space. It's dull. And it is expressing, showing, unrolling its dubious truth to a questioning mind. And this questioning mind is being compelled by the ignorant power, the unknowing force, to play its part. We think that our minds are free, but in fact they're very much driven and dominated by nature. No? But they are compelled to play their part in this unrolling and to record, register and note down this story of the unrolling of the ignorant force and the mystery of her plan, which seems to be, it's a contradiction in terms, an inconscient plan. A plan has been consciously planned with a purpose, no? But this plan seems to have been formed without consciousness. And how can a being, a conscious being, emerge from that night of ignorance, of total unconsciousness? It seems to have emerged through some kind of marriage connection between necessity and chance. This is the way that the materialistic mind shows us the world, not that it's emerged from this movement of material force, which is ruled by or establishes the laws of physics, so that everything is predetermined, fixed. It has to happen in a particular way through the interaction of the four laws of thermodynamics. No? This is a kind of necessity, inescapable necessity, which rules us all. But at the same time, there's something random happening. There's chance always bringing in something unexpected. And our world seems to have emerged and evolved by the interplay of these two factors, the factor of necessity and of chance. And a conscious being has emerged in all that. How is it possible? That's really a mystery and a riddle. That's how it looks to the questioning mind. Is it clear? Anybody wants to ask anything? We'll go on, Mihong.
This darkness hides our nobler destiny, a chrysalis of a great and glorious truth. It stifles the winged mouth.
So this is the one of the places where Sri Aurobindo gives us his reassurance and his prophecy of what we can expect to happen. Is it clear? Anybody wants to ask anything? I think the darkness is the chrysalis. It's that form that the insect takes in the process of its transformation, and this chrysalis is stifling, smothering the winged marvel of the spirit, of the soul. It doesn't allow it to escape from the prison of matter, because then it would just fly off like a beautiful butterfly into the other worlds, into the formless vast. It wouldn't play its part in changing, in fulfilling the world's miraculous fate. It has a part to play here in matter, and that's why it's imprisoned here in the chrysalis. And then he tells us that although we can't believe it at the moment, though it may seem a dream or an illusion, a new creation shall rise from this old one. And then a knowledge which at the moment is inarticulate, which can't express itself, will speak out and clearly. And great beauty that's now suppressed, that can't show itself, shall burst into paradise bloom. And these opposites of pleasure and pain, we shall discover that they are equally expressed in absolute bliss, or they will lose themselves in the experience of absolute bliss. An oracle is a channel for a higher knowledge, a divine knowledge. This oracle is tongueless, it's dumb, it can't speak, but it will speak, it will find its way to express itself. What is now super conscient to us will become conscious here on earth, and all the wonders of the eternal will join this dance, this play, this game that's going on in time. That's the promise. The Hiranyagarbha is what is inside the chrysalis, I think. The golden embryo, the winged marvel, no, that's going to manifest. But at the moment it's enclosed in the prison of matter. I think the chrysalis is the material world which is enclosing that glorious divine possibility. It's the darkness which is the chrysalis, no? Yeah. I think this is important to understand. We sometimes wonder why it's not easier for the inner consciousness to come out and express itself. And there's a general feeling that it's due to some kind of failure or mistake on our part, no, some terrible shortcoming. But it's really that the plan doesn't allow it. We have to remain closely connected with matter because we have a work to do here. We can't just fly off into the formless vast and leave the work undone. Helmut?
But now all seemed a vainly teeming vast upheld.
So that's the promise. But now when Asvapati looks at this world of ours from that world which will be from the new creation, it all looks like a vainly teeming vast. When we see sometimes on films or television the centers of cities just teeming, thousands of people running here and there, and one wonders what it is all for, what is the purpose of it. Of course, every one of those little teeming individuals, they do have their small purposes. But what is it all for, really? No? It seems like it's all in vain. And it's being held up by nature, by a deluded energy, an energy that is misled and doesn't know its way. It's being held up to this spirit, this spectator spirit, this spectator consciousness, who is actually absorbed in himself and silent. He doesn't respond. Actually, he really denies life. He's not at all interested in this meaningless show that is being put on for his benefit. He's watching this bizarre procession, this weird, meaningless procession pass, and it's as if he's just waiting for it all to be over. Expecting, waiting for the end. That's this other world based on two negations. So Asvapati sees that world that is our world from the world he's in, the new creation, the world that is to be. And he defined, like a water diviner finds water without really being able to say how he finds it. He senses in some way. He doesn't see or feel his body, his own body, in a kind of trance. For him, it's far off on the very rim horizon of consciousness on this transient and frail, this little whirling globe, our earth. And that's where he's left his body, which seems to be just the mold, the outer shape of a lost dream, or a fragile copy, something very, very breakable and perishable, an outer shell, a copy of the shell of the spirit. His body gathered into mystic sleep. It's in a state of trance. All his consciousness is up there in the new creation. And it seems when he senses it, it seems something that's alien to him, a foreign shade, a mythic shade, something that maybe isn't really real. In the common usage, this word myth, it means something that's not true, not a falsehood. Eve, you read.
Alien now seeing a thing.
Anything to ask or to share? We'll go on. Gunilla, will you read? Sorry, you wanted to ask about that? Yeah. Yeah.
I was a bit late.
Yeah.
To ask. This that ray that replies from the occult serene.
Supreme. No, this must be higher than Asvapati. He sees something coming from the supreme consciousness, a ray coming down and lighting up. It comes in response to that endless call of the earth, of the material universe. But that call passes through Asvapati's memory, through his individual consciousness. A memory comes up, and with it, that call which he's been carrying all the time on his quest, that aspiration. And that ray can reply, that response can come, because even in the ignorance, in the darkness of matter, the oneness is everywhere. Here it's unrecognizable to its own sight. We look around and we don't see the oneness normally. We see the manyness, the multitude. And in much of this multitude, the oneness, all its power and consciousness and bliss is sunk in its own tenebrous seas, its own shadowy seas of unconsciousness. But it's still there. It's still there, upholding this inconscient unity of the world, the oneness. It's holding everything together, hidden in matters, insentient multitude. All this manyness, the material manyness is insentient. It's not alive. It doesn't have senses or feelings. All the multitudinous forms, but the oneness is within even the most unconscious particles. It's clear? Yeah. Gunilla? Yes, one is never really alone. And there is even some kind of order and predictability. Of course, chance comes in, but there is some kind of human harmony holding things together so that we can live, we can have a sense of consciousness, we can have some kind of experience and grow. That's only because of the indwelling presence of the boundless oneness holding everything together, harmonizing everything, even when it seems most disharmonious. We'll go on.
This is said so in the terminus. Perfected glory of divinity. Conceiving the
I think that this seed self is the individual soul. This seed of the boundless oneness, which gets sown, planted in the indeterminate, the formlessness of the beginning of the universe. And when it accepts like that to be sown in the indeterminate formlessness, it gives up its essential nature, its glory of divinity. It hides its all-powerfulness of the spirit, of its force. It hides its all-knowledge. It's acting as an agent, working out its own transcendent will, the will of the oneness beyond manifestation. Here in the manifestation, it merges knowledge in the inconscient deeps, in the depths of the inconscious. And as it emerges in living forms, it accepts error and sorrow and death and pain. Because by this emerging process, it pays the ransom of the ignorant night. You pay a ransom to get back somebody who's been kidnapped or captured. So that ignorant night has to be rescued somehow. And it has to be rescued by the growing self-awareness of the soul as it develops in evolution. It redeems this fall of nature into unconsciousness and insentience by its substance. It's the soul substance in us which is gradually evolving all our higher possibilities and our destiny. This, yes. Yes, I think it's a kind of link between the oneness, what has gone before, and which is unrecognizable to its own sight. The oneness here in the material world is unrecognizable because in the form of this seed self, or these infinite number of seed selves, it has sunk in its own tenebrous seas. It's okay? Yeah? Tekeste, you like to read?
Himself in me and wise with his soul I go into us, passionate of grief, to share the dinner or by errant power. Which
Perhaps this is what that ray from the occult supreme reveals to Asvapati. It shows him that the boundless oneness is everywhere. It shows him the way that the seed self enters into the indeterminate and why it does that. So he suddenly realizes clearly, he experiences himself and why his soul has entered into this passionate obscurity of earth. This is a very, very special moment when the soul recognizes its mission. And he sees that his soul has entered to share the labor, the effort of this ignorant, wandering power, which is in by division, by making always new forms, is hoping to find again that one which she is always missing. And he sees himself in two beings, the one that he is above on the higher levels in the house of the spirit, experiencing that new creation, that one is his true self, wide and free above. But this other poor body on the earth, struggling, bound, intense, suffering, is its portion here. And if he can make a connection, he is the connection, no? Between them. He can bridge the two worlds, the higher world and the lower one. And so there is a response to that ray, a dim response, a distant breath. It's not that everything has ceased in that unbounded hush. There's still some connection between the two beings. And that's passing through the heart. And Patricia.
His heart lay somewhere, unconscious and alone.
Asvapati got swallowed into shoreless trance. And he moved into the house of the spirit with his consciousness. So then the heart, all his nature parts, got left behind. It's as if he's abandoned them. You know, his central being has gone off and had all these wonderful experiences. But now he becomes aware again of his heart lying abandoned. It's imperishable. It's immobile, with excess, too much, passionate will. It's carrying all his intense will and aspiration. This is his living, sacrificed and offered heart, which itself is in a kind of trance. It's absorbed in adoration mystical. And it's constantly turned to the far-off fount of light and love. It has fallen in love with the Supreme Mother, and it's turned towards him. It's silent, its call is mute, but it's luminous, that stillness. And it's looking up to those heights which it can't see. It's yearning from these depths which it's not able to leave. It can't fly up to the Mother like the spirit can. It is somewhere in between. So his heart has made a choice. It has accepted worship as its single law. It's dedicating itself entirely to worship of the Supreme Mother. And it's accepting that things exist only because of bliss. That bliss, Ananda, is the sole cause of things. And at the same time, it's accepting those two things, and then it's refusing. It's refusing the austere joy in which none can share. The joy of the spirit on its higher levels, abstracted, alone. And it refuses the calm that lives for calm alone. We need calm, but the true calm is a basis for dynamic action, for fulfillment. So that is the choice which Aswapati's heart has made, and it's turned towards her, towards the Supreme Divine Mother. It wants to exist only for her. And then comes this beautiful image, which we feel has been almost embodied in the inner chamber of the Matrimandir. His heart is lying somewhere halfway down below, between his free and his fallen selves, a closed, soundless oratory, a place that is meant for prayer. And in that oratory there's a consecrated, sacred silver floor gleaming, and it's lit by a single and untrembling ray. And there, in that oratory, there's an invisible presence always there in prayer. Thank you. Fiery point. So everything else in him is at rest on the deep breast of liberating peace. It's satisfied with this quietude, silence and calm and peace. It's only his heart which knows that that's not the ultimate truth, that there's a truth beyond that. All the other parts are concentrated, silent, in centered sleep. And they are accepting, consenting the way that nature works, the slow, deliberate power which is tolerating all the world's error and its grief. They are accepting the long time that it's taking, the cosmic long delay. They're ready to wait forever through timelessness, waiting through the patient years for her coming, for the coming of the Mother. They had asked for her coming for earth and men, but they are at peace, they are ready for it to take however long it takes. Only his heart is burning and calling for her to come now.
Question.
The mother is here not mentioned, so it is a part of light and love, with her then.
Wait a minute. It's indicated in several places. On line 546, it says that his heart was turned to her for whom it willed to be. And then there it mentions in line 560, her coming. So this is who the heart is adoring, absorbed in adoring, adoration mystical. It has consecrated itself entirely to the mother at the end of Canto 2. And everything that he has done since then, he undertook this tremendous tapasya to be able to embody the mother's power and love and bring it down on earth. But somehow, as a stage in that, he's had this entry into the house of the spirit, which has quietened all his nature parts, given him a supreme revelation of the one consciousness. And in that state, he's been given the vision of the new creation. We can say it, that vision comes in a way in a response to his aspiration. But it's not enough for that new creation to exist on the heights. It also has to come down to the earth. So here he was shown that there's a link between his free self, which is having that experience on the heights of consciousness, and the fallen self, the body here on earth. And between them is this consecrated, adoring heart full of the aspiration and the longing for the presence of the mother. And it's still calling. It felt actually abandoned when Asvapati's spirit went off into the heights, but this doesn't lose its consecration and its will. So you'll read to the end, Norman?
All other parts.
No, further down. Line 562, extinction.
Okay, number what?
Line 562, it begins extinction.
Extinction could not quench that lonely fire. Its seeing filled the blank of mind and will. Thought dead, its changeless force abode and grew. Armed with the intuition of a bliss to which some mood tranquility was the key, it persevered through life's huge emptiness amid the blank denials of the world. It sent its voiceless prayer to the unknown. It listened for the footsteps of its hopes, returning through the void immensities. It waited for the fire of the word that comes through the still self from the Supreme.
Thank you. Asvapati's gone through a kind of extinction of all his nature parts. It's described on page 322 when he is annulled, is the contact formed with time-born things. Empty grew nature's wide community. All things were brought back to their formless seed. The world was silent for an hour. So it's that kind of withdrawal from nature, separation from nature, that's allowed him to have this experience of the house of the spirit. But that extinction was not able to put out that lonely fire of the aspiration in his heart. That's something essential, timeless. It can't be put out. So the seeing of that fire of aspiration fills up the blank. The mind and the will are not there, no? Thought is dead. And that allows this changeless force of the heart to remain and to grow. It has the intuition of a bliss which can only be felt if there's some moved tranquility. Tranquility is peace and quietude, but tranquility can also be intense, passionate. It's like that. That is the key to the bliss which it's calling for. So that heart is persevering, it's remaining and continuing through the huge emptiness of the life and the blank denials, refusals and contradictions of the world. And its prayer is rising, not in words, in intense feeling to the unknown. And it's waiting, it's patiently listening for the footsteps of its hopes returning. It's waiting for them to come back to it through all that emptiness. It's waiting for the word of command, the fiat of the supreme creative word that comes from the supreme through the still self. If there's any movement in us, that word can't come. Everything has to be silent and receptive. This time we'll take up the final chapter of this book, which is called The Vision and the Boon. Maybe we'll listen to all the passages that Mother reads from this canto.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
was cased in the safety of light. It needed not a shield of ignorance.
Of the